The Protect Your Neck Podcast. Top 5 underdogs in MMA with Daniel Levy. From the forensics of a fight to memory lane, we dissect those we deem to be dogs.
Hot air hangs like a dead man from a white oak tree. People sitting on porches thinking how things used to be. Dark night. It's a dark night. Dark.
What is up, degenerates and degenerates alike? Or as I like to say, yes, my friends. And in the spirit of friends, we on the Protect Your Neck podcast, or I should say I, your host, Dan Tom, has a co-host today. One of my favorite hosts, because he hosts his own show, Half the Battle. That's right. It is the man himself, Daniel Levy.
Dan Tom, thanks so much for having me on the show, dude. I've been looking forward to this all week. If you put a gun to my head and asked me if I could only bet one kind of bet for the rest of my life, whether it's a favorite, an underdog, a parlay, or a prop, 10 times out of 10, I would tell you it's an underdog. I live and die by the underdog, so I'm pumped to do this episode, dude.
Dude, I'm so glad you're pumped. I'm pumped, too. And again, kind of alluding to what he said, this is a top five episode. Usually we will break down or recap, which we could touch on a few things, which not to hijack the episode or anything, touch on a few things from this past weekend. But yes, the point of the episode, it's a top five episode. We have a rare, 3 week break, 2 weekends, 3 weeks off from the UFC, at least for MMA events. And as you know, that's my focus. Levy, I know you do Bellator plays and you're good about, fitting in, hot plays that are outside the UFC program with your show. Again, Half the Battle, a great show that I suggest you all listen to, but, your focus and not to speak too much for yourself, but my focus here on this show is yes, UFC. So the top five helps. We're going to be doing top five underdogs and yeah, what better person to have than at Best Fight Picks here on Twitter for the underdog picks, right? I mean, we're not just doing the plays here, by the way. This is career perspectives. This is individual performances. This is any way you want to cut it. You are more than encouraged to get creative here in the Protect Your Neck podcast. And if you got creative, if you submitted a top five list using the hashtag the Protect Your Neck podcast, we will read it off after ours, of course, in the submissions in transition segment. So I guess before we jump into the top five, as stoked as I am to kind of get into that, I promised the listeners, because everyone was asking for me to do an after party edition, and I frankly I wasn't too tired. That was my excuse for like the week before, but no, I actually had my buddy Jeff's birthday party to go to. Thankfully, the show ended early for us West Coast United Staters. It was UFC London. I didn't do too well. I'm gonna throw it over here to Daniel in a second, because I'm pretty sure, I don't want to speak for him again, but I'm pretty sure he did well. I know he hit a lot of some of his key plays, but yeah, both my key plays were scrapped, which was Tom Breeze and Brett Johns there. So that was kind of scrapped from it. It kind of soured the card. But how did you do, Daniel, before I speak too much here?
I did great, man. I mean, Arnold Allen and Chito Vera came through for me. And, win or lose, you got to accept the results and move on. Doesn't matter. You know what I mean? But if you do have a loss, learn from the mistakes and go forward. And that's what you got to do. Breeze and Brett Johns got scrapped for me as well. But luckily, Chito came through, he found a way to win even though he was down on the card. So I was pumped about that. And also Arnold Allen, that kid's pretty impressive, man. I thought that he'd have a 30-27 type performance, but he showed me he could overcome the adversity when he got taken down early. And he gassed out Makwan Amirkani and went to work on him.
I was with you in spirit in the sense that I was surprisingly kind of confident in him, but I guess I didn't see the 30-27. I thought it was going to be a little close because, again, Makwan is real dangerous early. But props to you, man, on the Chito Vera. If you didn't know this guy's story already, it's very touching, but it makes it that much more impressive, the fact that it went from a sour mood, if you were, people in the audience, or like myself, just a huge Brad Pickett fan. Nothing against Chito Vera. You felt bad for the guy's retirement, but Chito turned it around and turned the crowd around, which was so damn impressive. Because you're a big Vera guy. I'm going to throw it to you here in a second, Levy. But for me, when you watch Chito Vera and you don't know like his touching story with his daughter, and you see the savage in the fight, he reminds me of like a young Roberto Duran. You know, that prime Roberto Duran, just that savage who's always in the fight, and he can almost rub you the wrong way because he gets so competitive. And you'll see him shoulder bump guys, and if you don't understand gamesmanship, you can take it the wrong way, like introducing someone to a Diaz brother for the first time. Like, those guys are jerks, and they don't quite get it. And to see, you know, Chito Vera, every respect to be a savage in this fight, was just so respectful throughout. It was really awesome to see. What was your takeaways from that with that one?
I love Chito Vera. Now, first of all, that moment you were talking about right after the fight, that was one of the greatest moments, in my opinion, in recent MMA history, maybe in MMA history in general. I mean, what an incredible moment, because, you know, he totally could have been a dick there, but instead he really gave Brad Pickett his due respect. I mean, Brad Pickett's a guy that he was the first man to beat Demetrius Mighty Mouse Johnson. He, you know, for a while there in the UFC, it would be fight of the night after fight of the night. I believe he was the only man in WEC history to get a Peruvian necktie. Correct me if I'm wrong there. But I mean, look, Brad Pickett, how can you not love the guy? Always comes to fight, and he went out on a shield like Brad Pickett does. That moment was incredible. I mean, if you weren't crying tears of joy, you're full of shit or you don't have a heart. And a lot of people don't realize with Chito Vera, he's only been training at a high-level gym for 6 months, Dan. You know what I mean? Before that, a lot of people don't realize this kid was training in Ecuador with just random people that would show up to the gym, no pro fighters. And then after the loss to Davy Grant, he moved his family to California under Team Oyama, and he's had two straight wins since. And obviously, you know, he's fighting for a smile, you know, for his daughter, man. His daughter has a syndrome where she literally can't smile, and he's fighting to put a smile on her face, man. It's a touching story, and I've never seen a more motivated 24-year-old in my life. So I truly believe the sky is the limit for Chito Vera. I know that right now it's not the finished product because, like I said, it's only been 6 months of high-level training. You got to give this kid time to develop, but you know, he's got the size for the weight class. He doesn't take that much damage. He's got athleticism, and he's a finisher. So, yeah, and the most important thing is his mentality. So that's what I like about him. Keep an eye on him.
Yeah, his mentality has never changed, but his fight-to-fight improvements completely support the theory you just laid out. And I heard you lay that theory out before the fights. This isn't after-the-fact stuff that you've been touting, but it's correct, sir. I mean, and I'm impressed. Like I said, on the technical side, and of course, you know me, I'm a soppy guy, so of course I appreciate that emotional ending there for that one. But pardon me, nothing's really jumping out on me to the card, but unless something's jumping out on you that you wanted to touch
Mark
on.
Mark DeCasey.
Yes, there we go. That jumped out. There we go. He's already has like matchups booked while we're recapping this, by the way. I mean, not really, but you know what I'm saying. It's being talked about. Yeah,
man.
Yeah.
Him and Paul Felder, it's so intriguing because, you know, obviously – a lot of people don't know that DeCasey's only 23 or 24 years old. He's just a kid. Like, a lot of us think that he's, you know, 27, 28, something like that. But he's still raw. He's still developing. But he's got that ridiculous, you know, dynamicism that carries him through and makes up for, you know, the lack of I don't want to say the lack of technical skill, because that would be discrediting him completely, because one does not simply do a front leg sidekick to a jumping, you know, spinning back kick to the face. You don't just do that. You have to be a serious athlete and have ridiculous technique to pull off a move like that inside the UFC's octagon. But what I am trying to say, Dan, is that, you know, he's not a guy that right now, at least, that goes out there, establishes his jab, you know, will pick you apart. He's going out there to take you out. So definitely keep an eye on with Paul Felder. Obviously, we know he's a very technical guy. You know, he comes to fight every single time. So I'm very intrigued by that matchup.
You nailed it, man. I mean, there's so many fun matchups in this division, and I hope UFC takes time to do those, not just selfishly as a fan, but like you said, this guy's super young. Like, he's plenty of time to develop. We don't need to put him into the progressive top 10 or top 15, you know, unless it's the fringes for a fun type matchups. I'm in no way to rush this guy, but I do want to rush these fun matchups. Now, two more things just to cap this card before the main event. Just one question. Joseph Duffy, what do you want to see next to him? If it was up to Daniel Levy, you were management, you were the powers that be, whatever have you, well, what's next for Joseph Duffy?
Man, that is such a good question. And I wish I had a name for you off the top of my head, but if I was his manager, right, you know, even though, you know, obviously I'm not, right, I would say sign with the UFC and hopefully he gets a top 15 fight because he clearly is a top 15 guy. And also, you know, this is one thing that we're going to talk about on the show that's a common theme. He faced defeat like a champion. A lot of people don't face defeat like champions, man. A lot of people, you know, they take a whooping and they don't come back the same. With Joe Duffy, he came back against Mitch Clark, dropped him, you know, within 25 seconds, choked him out. And then against Reza, a guy who – Reza tried his hardest to stay in that fight. Reza wasn't just going to go down on the first shot. You know what I mean? Yep, Reza was willing to go through some shit to win the fight. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to. But that made Joe Duffy really have to be like, all right, well, you know, I'm not just technically proficient. I got the heart, the will to win, the mentality too. You know, if you're not going to go down on the first couple hard shots, that's fine. I'll keep picking you apart for the rest of the fight, you know, and win that 30-27. And all week he was saying that this is going to be a 3-round fight. You know what I mean? And I thought that was just, you know, that was gamesmanship, you know, and turns out it really was a 3-round fight. And yeah, Joe Duffy is the real deal.
I love how you say, you know, taking the ass whooping like a man, because it's true. I mean, even after like those worst rounds with Poirier, Duffy gave that classic, you know, it's becoming classic now, in my opinion, that Duffy smirk, like, all right, all right. And I even caught myself doing it the other night where this guy just manhandled me and, like, he didn't tap me, but he came, like, ultra close and dominated me, so where he might as well have tapped me, because I was just, you know, playing defense, surviving, floating. And at the end, it was one of those things where, you know, I have, you know, a strong character enough where I don't take that stuff personally or whatever. So I just kind of smile at the guy like, that was a really good role, man, because it was a fun role. I mean, even though I was getting my ass kicked, it was a fun role. I was able to take the positives and it didn't affect me. And that's a very, very micro scale. So to see a someone do it on a major scale in an actual fight at a UFC level against a guy like Dustin Poirier and then still be able to give that, I'm like, wow, that you're right. That really says something about the guy. And he came out and showed it against a tough, underratedly tough guy in Madotti.
So, and to your point about the smirk, you know, it's kind of like a psychopathic grin in a way. It's like he's really looking forward to whooping your ass, because you recall the fight with Dustin Poirier. Let's talk about that for a second. You know, Sean Carey brought up a really good point on Half the Battle about how in the first round, you know, Dustin Poirier stood over Joe Duffy. He throws one of the nastiest elbows you've ever seen in your life, and Joe Duffy smiles at him. You know what I'm saying,
exactly,
Dan? That's the kind of character we're dealing with. So I really hope the UFC, you know, sees the value and brings him back, man, because look, now I've had enough time to think about a matchup, and how about him versus the winner of Rashid Magomedov versus Bobby Green?
Ooh, that's good. I mean, I don't know how pleasing. I think the Bobby Green would force a fight that's pleasing on all levels to all palates, whereas Rashid Magomedov versus Duffy would be like, for guys like us, or like, you know, like,
bro, really, I'd love, know, that fight. Bro. I'd dork out on that one, bro.
Even if it was the slow version of it, like, we would still enjoy it, but like the masses wouldn't, kind of a thing. And I'm okay with that. But I could see that maybe scaring off the matchmakers. I would love it. I would take it over the Bobby Green fight. And Bobby Green makes, you know, win or lose, that guy always makes an exciting fight. So that's not a bad idea either. But let's get to this main event, man. This was a classic where, like, I came in leaning one way and went the other, but I was wrong, and I should have stuck with my gut, because I just – every way I saw this fight, I couldn't not see Jimmy Manuel knocking Corey Anderson out. But then when I went and did the math, I ended up siding with, you know, more routes to victory, et cetera, et cetera. This is just the basic outline that, you know, if he survived, if he gets past those initial knockout blows, those initial rounds, it should be Corey Anderson's fight. And I ended up reluctantly siding with Anderson. And yeah, again, it was reluctant, but I still should have sided with my initial, because Manuel knocked him out of the park. Who did you have for this one officially?
Manuel, but I mean, I didn't bet on it, so it's not really big of a deal. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I was going to say it was dumpster fire for sure as far as like betting on.
Yeah, I mean, with Corey Anderson, look, man, people are kind of slow to realize the dude's chinny as hell. I mean, he does the chicken dance of chicken dances in all of his fights. I mean, the Tom Lawler fight, the Jean Valente fight, obviously the Jimmy Manuel fight, the Shogun fight. I mean, how many fights do we got to list before we finally realize, look, that's just how he is, man. But, you know, if he does get past that, then he's able to outwork you. He's got size. He can take you down. You know, that fight with Jan Blankovic, man. A lot of people don't realize that Jan Blankovic was laying on the canvas for 5 minutes after that fight because he got worked for 15 minutes straight. But, man, Corey's going to have to find a way to work around that chin. You know what I mean? He's going to have to develop a game plan kind of like Alistair Overeem. It's going to be hard because he doesn't have that kind of high-level striking. But at the same time, when you work with a guy like Mark Henry, you're only going to improve leaps and bounds. So I expect Corey Anderson, you know, to improve. But I feel like maybe he shouldn't be fighting, you know, top five guys right now. Maybe take it. It is a shallow division, don't get me wrong, but maybe take it, you know, fringe top 15, work your way back up and take it from there. As far as Manny was concerned, you know, he called the shots. He said he wanted the winner of Rumble versus DC, and who am I here to tell him that he can't do it? I mean, the guy, look, like we said earlier about Duffy, Manny faced defeat like a champion. Not only has he lost once, he's lost twice by knockout. Both times he's come back, and now he's, in my opinion, on the best run of his career because, you know, up until now, he's just been injuring guys in the UFC, right? But now he finally has two highlight reel knockouts in a row. And, you know, against OSP, that's a guy that no one's ever knocked out before. I mean, that's a guy that went five rounds with John Bones Jones, a guy that's known for his durability. And Jimmy Manuel knocked him out the park. And then obviously with Corey Anderson, he beat him faster than anyone else has beat him up until this point as well. So I would say a title shot is next for Jimmy Manuel.
Yeah, it's hard to argue with any of those points there. And about the chin, yeah, I mean, you know, kind of even strengthened that point. I wouldn't say I was someone on the opposite because, again, like with this whole fight, you couldn't be sure either way, especially for betting. So, you know, I recommended staying away from it in my breakdown, and I hope you did because I was wrong because I was wrong on it. But yeah, it was one of those things where I guess I'm not any more convinced about Manawa's abilities, although I'm much more excited for sure. I mean, I was a fan of his before, and you know, I'm much more excited now. But as far as technically what we saw, you know, first round left hook knockout in that regard, not trying to simplify and take anything away from his work, but I'm just saying in the grand spectrum, we didn't learn a ton. Whereas my opinions swayed with Corey Anderson's chin. I was one of the people that said, not that I would argue against it, because there was certainly evidence you could point to, you know, like you were saying, of Corey Anderson's chin. But I was one of those people that was saying, you know, let's just wait. Because if it is this bad and he does get, you know, if he does show it this Manoa fight, it's going to be troublesome. It's going to turn into, oh, it's okay, he's still young, to he's still young and he's already facing these problems. You see, the perspective can really change there. And it did for me, because after this fight, I said, okay, I give in. You know, it's real. There really is some chinny issues there. And that's what's worrisome, because we've even seen the outliers in the sport of people to come back at the heavier weight classes. Well, it's a heavier weight class, you can come back. Well, let's look at the one outlier who came back from chin issues, Alistair Overeem. What do we still point to when he fights? Chin issues. You know, and he's like the outlier, right? He's this technical, you know, probably has better submission and striking skills than even Anderson will ever achieve. You know what I'm saying? With his ceiling and stuff, arguably, at least, you know, on the ground. But yeah, that's the point, and that's where it kind of gets worrisome for Corey Anderson. But yeah, I'm with you. I don't mind seeing top five title contention, title challenge matchups for Manoa. He completely deserves it. I'll buy the pay-per-view if you put him on there. He's one of those fighters that I want to watch. But all right, man, we were so excited we almost just skipped over that. And I've skipped over stuff, those recaps before, so I wanted to at least touch on it. But now the time has come. We are going to do our top five underdogs. And again, for this is you can think outside the box, but it's generally plays, career perspectives, and performances. It almost gets really dangerously close, and I'm sure you'll touch on this with your list, Levy, that underdogs get close with upsets. That, like, a lot of people, I noticed their suggestions, which weren't wrong, and I'm going to read those off. Again, no wrong answers, but a lot of them were like upset lists, and I found myself doing that too, and there's nothing wrong with that because they do fall in the same line. And even though you could do like a top five upsets episode, I think it would get it's a much more narrower topic, and I think we would have a lot more of the same top five. So doing top five underdogs allow us to kind of incorporate upsets and, you know, all those things all into one. So we're going to go from five to one here before we get to any honorable mentions or your lists. And got to give it to my guest, Daniel Levy. The ball's in your court first, sir. Would you be so kind as to give the listeners your number five top five underdog?
My number five top five underdog pick is Christoph Jocko. Look, this is a kid that he's a winner through and through. 19-1 record. And, you know, what I really like about him is it's kind of interesting. He kind of reminds me of like a Southpaw European kickboxer version of GSP, in the sense that you know, it's not necessarily always the most exciting for everyone, but he finds a way to get it done, and he's an expert at winning the close decision. And when I'm looking to bet on an underdog or just someone in general, you know, obviously you can't always depend on someone to finish the fight. You need a guy that, if it's going to the scorecards, you know for a fact he's going to do what it takes to win that fight, be ahead on the judges' scorecards, and he's not opposed to beating you at your own game either. You know, you watched that fight with Talis Latis, and going into that, you know, my only worry was like, well, what if Talis Latis takes him down? And then you see Christoph Jocko taking Talis Latis down and full mounting Talis Latis. I was like, damn. This kid is really good everywhere. You know, I like his size for the weight class. You know, he's not too big. He's kind of faster, quick on his feet. I love his movement, the southpaw stance, obviously. And now he's starting to really develop his hands and his power, as you saw in the Tamden McCrory fight. And a lot of people might laugh and be like, oh, Tamden McCrory. But yeah, before that fight, all you guys were hyping him up. Jocko was a plus 200 dog in that fight against Tamden McCrory. Prior to that fight, McCrory starts two guys in Bellator, comes in the UFC, gets a finish. Then he got the fight with Jocko. Jocko was plus 200. Jocko put him away in under a minute. Hashtag Jocko changes lives, because after Jocko fights dudes, they don't come back the same. And I don't think Talis Latis is going to come back the same either. We'll find out when he fights Sam Alvey. But yeah, Jocko is my number five pick.
I'm glad you brought him up on this one. My number five almost was in the section of plays, or, you know, career perspectives, kind of who they are as well. But I went with something different, which I'll get to in a second. But Christoph Jocko, as someone who's been on the opposite side of you as Jocko, I can completely 100% attest to the things you're saying, because I've picked against him, and you're right. I've heard you on previous shows, you know, on your show. You know, you're one of the few people that waves his flag. Yeah, 100%. And the reason why I'm glad you brought him up, because he represents a theme. It's not so much Jocko. It's a theme that he represents. It's going to come up with a lot of guys on this list and a lot of other people's lists. And that's being awkward, maybe even being a southpaw. These are a lot of common themes we might see with a lot of these classic underdogs, because not so much being a southpaw and the problems that you know, presents when you start to break it down in traditional boxing and outside foot awareness. I'm talking about that a lot of awkward fighters, a lot of karate fighters, which are, you know, especially because we don't understand karate fighters, we go, oh, well, he's awkward, he's a karate fighter, when really we don't understand what he's doing. Or there's like awkward grapplers like a Teemu Pakkalin, or they have these really kind of weird styles, and you're like, oh, this guy sucks. And you're like, well, obviously he's not great of a striker, as he got just iced by Diakhaissi, but he's a better grappler than meets the eye, because, you know, it's a very awkward style, and this kind of hot word awkward can be thrown out there to label something we don't understand. But if you do understand it, like, maybe, you know, I have a beat on a karate guy, or you know, Levy here is talking about, you know, Christoph Jocko, and he's always had this kind of solid beat and read on him. They can be your best friends as underdogs, you know, and come through, because you'll see that even the odds makers are kind of confused. Hence, they're bigger underdogs, and maybe they should be in a lot of spots. Christoph Jocko definitely represents those things. And if he wasn't on your radar, if you were like me and you underestimated him, you probably aren't anymore. So it's going to be real interesting seeing him going forward.
But, you know what's cool? You know what's funny, Dan?
Yeah.
Is that you'd think people would learn their lessons, but that's what's so, you know, beautiful about underdogs. Yes, is that yes. They're consistently underrated. And as the, you know, the lists progress, you're going to see what we're talking about. You know what I mean?
Oh, man. Because
a lot of these guys, you'll be like, you know, okay, well, he was a plus 450 dog there, and he just TKO'd the guy. And I'll tell you what example I'm talking about in a bit. And then his next fight, he's a plus 220. And then his next fight, he's a plus 200. They keep counting this one guy out. I can't wait to talk about him.
Oh, my God. I think this one guy – I almost want to change my number five right now, because I think that's who it is. But since he's on your list, I'm just going to hope we're on the same page here, and I'm going to wait for that to come up on your list. And instead, I'm sticking to my original number five. This was one of the first ones on my list, but at the 11th hour is one of those where I started kind of changing my mind on for that aforementioned fighter that I think you're leading to. But this is more of an individual performance, underdog performance. Sometimes it's hard to say a certain guy is an underdog. We're like, well, this guy's a champion in this. How is he an underdog? This guy's already a world-class, you know, fighter. But this is one of those examples. And that is Joe Warren in Dream 9 against Kid Yamamoto. This was his second professional fight. What was his first professional fight? Oh, that's right. It was another fight overseas in Japan against a former WEC champion, Chase Beebe. That was his first fight. in which he won by TKO. His second professional fight, granted, Joe Warden, you know, Greco-Roman, you know, Olympics, wrestling accolades, All-American, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I get it. Those are the outliers that can do this. But still, like, you don't understand. Like, Kid Yamamoto was, like, the shit. He was the waver of the flag for the lighter guys. He was the Uriah Faber, so to speak, of Japan, except Japan still had contender guys, and Uriah Faber was on his rise and getting bigger than ever, and they were actually trying to put this fight together. They tried to put it together so many times that it wouldn't fall through, and then I think, you know, the WEC contracts kind of got a little more stringent when the UFC came on board, but this little young cat, Joseph Benavidez, was coming up under Uriah Faber, so Uriah Faber's like, you know what, if I can't get you, I'm going to have Benavidez get you, and then that match gets pulled out because Kid Yamamoto drops out 3 days before, and Uriah Faber's like, God, I can't even get him like vicariously through anybody. And then Joe Warren, from training with Team Quest, goes to Team Alpha Male, where he trains under Uriah Faber. And Uriah Faber goes, I'm going to use Warren to get him. And Warren helps Warren set up that fight for his second pro fight, because he says, I know how to beat Kid Yamamoto, and you have the tools because you're a wrestler like me and Joseph Benavidez. Joe Warren goes out there. It's a split decision in Japanese territory. It upsets the world, and everybody just went from who's Joe Warren to who's Joe Warren? So that's my number five, is Joe Warren versus Kid Yamamoto.
Yeah, I mean, Joe Warren, he definitely has a way of, you know, taking that ass-whooping in the first round and then coming back. You recall that fight with Joe Soto, and it was the same story. Yes. He was getting dropped all over the place, and then he comes back. He actually knocks him out in the second round. So, yeah, man, Joe Warren, isn't he, like, in his 40s now or something like that? Like, he's still fighting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think he was 33 when that fight happened, and so it was, like, kind of the end of his athletic prime, especially for a wrestler, because they're, like – they're like 53 by 33, right? With all their back and neck, and like you said, even though he's a world class fighter, like you said, Daniel, he has that underdog spirit, you know. Whether it was his what developed to be chin issues and knockout losses later in his career, but he brought those intangibles to a fight that made those gritty, memorable fights. And to have memorable fights, you need, you know, or to have fight of the nights, you need two-way action, right? It's never a fight of the night award if one guy, you know, you know Diego Sanchez, BJ Penn, it's not a fight of the night. It was a great fight, but, you know, that's a one-sided ass kicking. You know what I'm saying? Like, you need to have two-way action, and to have two-way action, you need yourself a good underdog. So with that,
Dan,
yep.
So sorry to cut go, you know, as far as my thought slipped my mind, so go ahead.
Oh, sorry. If it comes back, please interrupt me again. Don't apologize. Right. Before we take our break, we're going to knock out our number four, and then we'll come back with our top three. So if you don't mind taking the lead, Mr. Levy, again, would you mind giving the listeners your number four?
Well, since you brought up something that had to do with Bellator, it's kind of interesting because my number four pick is a Bellator fighter, and it's Emmanuel El Matador Sanchez, man. I mean, this kid finds a way to win as well, which is also, you know, that's what you need with these underdogs, man. And with him, you know, he's so damn tough, and he's willing to fight you in any area of the fight. You know, there's, you know, it's funny, in that Georgie Karakhanian fight, I was like, well, the one thing I'm worried about is Georgie getting on top of him. And then it's Emmanuel who's, you know, taking the back of Georgie Karakhanian. He's got zero opposition to beating you at your own game. You recall that Justin Lawrence fight. I'm like, well, shit, the one thing we got to watch out for is, you know, the head kicks of a guy like Justin Lawrence. And then it's Emmanuel Sanchez who's rocking Justin Lawrence with head kicks. So this kid is as tough as they come, and you know, he was just a kid fighting dudes like Pat Curran and Daniel Vichel, who I believe that he beat, and now, you know, he's about to take on Marcos Galvo, which, you know, I'm chomping at the bit for that one. I hope he's an underdog again, but dude, I think he's got what it takes to go on and beat a guy like Daniel Strauss. I truly believe this kid's going to be a world champion for Bellator and then hopefully come into the UFC too. Very talented. And, you know, a lot of people like to talk about his toughness, and rightfully so, because he is so damn tough. But he's also very skilled too, Dan. I mean, you can't, you know, tough gets knocked out. That's how the saying goes. But this kid is skilled too. That's, you know, and obviously he's got the Mexican spirit, the chin. I love this kid, Emmanuel Sanchez.
Oh, man, yeah, you want to keep bringing up guys that I've been wrong about. I want to call him Emmanuel Spoiler, because not only do I stay away from the Bellator parlays, but, yeah, I've learned my lesson betting against that guy. Because, again, like, people might not think these are big names, but I have a lot of respect for guys like Georgie Karakhanian, even Justin Lawrence and stuff. And yeah, I agree with the Whitechill fight. So, I mean, that is a very good pick. I mean, for you know, Bellator can be great for underdogs if you know what you're looking for, and I know you wave that flag big time, my man. And And yeah. How can you not have love, you know, for Emmanuel Sanchez, or Emmanuel Spoiler, I should say. How can you not have love for him, though? Seriously, he's definitely got to watch. And, you know, Strauss is another guy I have respect for. But, oh, you can better believe that's going to be a fight if that happens, you know. So
definitely. And dude, the thought that slipped my mind was when I was younger, it kind of used to bother me that Joe Warren would call himself the baddest man on the planet. But now, you know, now I kind of understand it a little bit, because like the dude got knocked out cold twice in a row and he still comes out and calls himself the baddest man on the planet, which is kind of like, all right, man, you didn't back down from your stance. You still believe that, you know, because back in the day, I was like, you know, he's this short little, you know, I was like, yeah okay. Oh, you're the baddest man on the planet. All right, dude. But, you know, now he's like, you know, 40 something years old. He still calls himself the baddest man on the planet. So I'm like, yeah, I respect this dude a lot. So that's what I was going to say earlier.
Nice, nice. Absolutely, man. And I think a lot of that's like that, that like wrestling, and, you know, maybe from Team Quest working with, you know, Randy Couture, because Randy had that mental attitude too, where he just would take words out of his definition. He was obviously less boisterous, a little more of a humble guy, but it was the same spirit of approach, in the sense that Randy would never say no. He would never say, there were certain words that he would just take out of his vocabulary, would refer to things as a challenge. Like, it would sound like a cheesy, like, oh, he's doing just the, you know, that's his word for the UFC promo videos. But no, that was just a word he would use every day, because he was always, you know, you would use that word, I guess, like challenge, you know. It was a really smart dictionary. But yeah, that's what it reminded me of when you went off on that Joe Warren. But before I get off on a tangent, I guess I'll circle back to my number four. This is a more obvious pick, okay? But I couldn't not leave him on. This is a career perspective. And as a career perspective, I'd be remiss if I left Mark Hunt off this list. I don't know if he's on yours, but or an honorable mention, but Mark Hunt, as a career perspective, is on my list. He's not. I mean, just looking at the guy, he is. You know, he's a heavier set gentleman. Doesn't look like the most athletic guy in the world. And then, you know, you go back to his career of jumping in matchups, that, you know, being poorly managed on the Japanese scene, being thrown in there with like Fedor, Manhoff, just kind of showing up, not knowing who he's gonna fight. And then the whole, you know, story that, you know, more people know with the UFC and the contract issue, how they almost – he was one of the few guys where they essentially paid him to, hey, you don't actually have to come over with all the guys that we're buying out. We'll actually pay you your stuff up front here, pay out your contract, in fact, and you can go ahead and stay at home. And he said, no, I'm going to get in there, made it a point, comes – gets submitted by Sean McCorkle, very embarrassing, Kimura loss. And then puts on a win streak, and it was kind of a reluctant win streak because it started slow. I mean, there was a decision win over Rothwell in that drudged, you know, heavyweight card where the UFC had the bright idea to fill their main card with heavyweight fights at Elevation. And if you remember, Mark Hunt versus Ben Rothwell was one of those, and he had his fight with, you know, Stefan Struve, which was a war. Everyone remembers the end, but that fight was a war. Like, Mark Hunt gave Stefan Struve every opportunity to submit him when he was winning that fight, as Mark Hunt will tend to do in his fights. Because, yes, even when Mark Hunt's winning a fight, he will find ways to make it, you know, a war and uglier than it needs to be sometimes. And, you know, from just looking at the number of fights that he was marked as an underdog officially on the books to, you know, that career perspective, I would be remiss to leave Mark Hunt off this list. He is a quintessential underdog, if there is one.
100%, man. I mean, Mark Hunt's a legend. What else is there to say? For me, my favorite thing he does is that leaping left hook. I mean, the walk-off knockout. He's a legend. Also, he's one of the few that can really set up that rear uppercut. You know the deal with the rear uppercut. If you don't set up that rear uppercut, you're getting taken out. I mean, you recall a fight between Kevin Lee and Leo Santos, and Kevin tried to throw that rear uppercut, and Leo banged the overhand right over the top, and that's all she wrote. But a guy like Mark Hunt, he knows how to set up that rear uppercut with the jab, with the 1-3, and yeah, legend of the sport. Love seeing him walk off knockout dudes.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to get to our top three and your top five underdog list when we come back right here on the Protect Your Neck podcast.
Cucarachas enojadas.
And we're back right here on the Protect Connect podcast with Daniel Levy and your host, Dan Tom, here for the top five underdogs in MMA. We left off at number three, and the spirit of hospitality, why don't you kick us off, sir, Mr. Levy?
Number three, Jorge Gamebred Masvidal. I mean, look. You can make an argument that this guy's undefeated in the UFC. All his losses are controversial split decisions. And, you know, when you're betting on a fight, you want to bet on the guy that knows how to win the decision. But don't let that fool you. This guy wins more often than not. It's just the times that he has lost were controversial. But I think with the new scoring, it's going to favor a guy like Jorge Gamebred Masvidal because he's one of these guys that will go out there and absolutely style on you. And, you know, he might drop you a couple times and he might start to feel bad for you and then coast a little bit in that third round. And then the judges score it for the other guy. But now with the new scoring that they really look at damage a lot, there's more 10-8 rounds. I think that favors a guy like Gamebred. And, I mean, obviously he's good in all areas of the game. What he's really known for is, I would say, you know, his boxing for MMA, man. I mean, one does not simply finish Jorge Gamebred Masvidal. To take this guy out, you got to fucking put him in like an inverted triangle or something like that, you know, because you're not going to go out there and finish Gamebred Masvidal. You have to pray to finish a guy like that, man. So, yeah, he's my number three pick for sure.
Dude, that's a good one because people forget, like, there's, like, almost, like, three different iterations now for Jorge Masvidal. I mean, he's really kind of had to work for that respect because he was gaining respect coming from the underground. Of course, everybody knows now, you know, the Kimbo fighting scenes. And then in his early MMA career coming up through, like, you know, fight promotions like Bodog, where he started to build a name for himself. And then when he got to Bellator, he would be, you know, kind of posterized in a submission sense by the inverted triangle. You know, a submission loss there to his name's escaping me now.
Toby Amada.
There we go. Yes, sir. And then kind of we would see him build himself back up. The hardcore's in the know. We're like, this guy's still, you know, pardon the pun, this guy's still game. And I even remember when his fight in Strikeforce, you know, the second iteration of Jorge Masvidal in Strikeforce, where he earned himself a title shot against Gilbert Melendez. And people in the know, you know, were like, this guy is live going into this fight. Like, people in the know knew how live Gamebred was when he shows up to fight. You know, I believe it was a loss, but even against, you know, Paul Daly, one of the fights where Paul Daly, was highlighted.
That was close.
Yeah, it was
that
very
was close, bro.
It came down to a couple, exchanges against the cage it came down to?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there's an argument that Masvidal won that fight. It's funny. Hashtag rob more than a 7-Eleven. You know what I mean?
Yes, yes. Holy shit. Shark fights, I believe that was for. And yeah, I mean, there was that iteration of Masvidal too. And then he gets to the UFC and we saw, you know, the struggle at lightweight like you were talking about with the split decisions specifically, although that did follow him to welterweight as well. And now I think like third time's a charm to where, you know, if he's, you know, kind of coming to fruition like a lot of us hope he is, he might not be on this underdog list a year from now, my friend. But he is, though. Yes, he for a long time in his career, people don't realize, you know, Masvidal has had to not just be an underdog, but kind of work hard and hustle as an underdog. He's really had to hustle through his career, inside fights, and just when you look at these different levels of having to build himself up to the top, having a little trip up, and then having to build himself back up. Like, the dude's put in his dues. No one can argue that.
And he's an underdog once again as he takes on Damian Maia, currently listed at +105. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, which way the public takes it. But once again, you know, everyone thinks that his opponent's going to win. And obviously Damian Maia is a tough stylistic matchup for anyone, not just in the welterweight division, but in the UFC. But with a guy like Gamebred Masvidal, he's got very underrated wrestling, you know, because he only uses his wrestling defensively for, you know, for the most part. But at the same time, I can point to times in fights where he's gone out there and blast double dudes as well. So it's not like he can't take you down. But in a fight against a guy like Maia, expect a lot of sprawling and brawling, Chuck Liddell style. Kind of like, I was going to say kind of like Rory McDonald did to Maia, but that's not really sprawling and brawling. That's more like sprawling and tri-starring. With Jorge Masvidal, it's going to be some old school sprawl and brawl. I'm really excited for this matchup, man.
Man, talk about interesting narratives, interesting dynamics. That fight's going to have a lot of them. I can't wait to talk about that fight for sure. But my number three, this guy wouldn't. Man, I have so many. It's funny. A lot of my. That's why I'm glad. That's why I brought Daniel Levy on the program. He is he's bringing up awesome points and these awesome characteristics in fighters, because a lot of the guys that I had that fits these categories, they didn't make the cut at like the 11th hour here. So I'm really glad that we have this nice balance, because this next guy is not necessarily a guy who, if you were to bet on him in general, you would have, you know, done particularly well. His record was 6-5, but I'll be damned if this guy doesn't earn a spot on an underdog in spirit as far as career perspective. When you don't talk about, well, first of all, if I were to bring up any tough, any to kind of tip a cap to my pick here, if I were to pick anyone from a tough run, the Ultimate Fighter, how do you not talk about Amir Sadala? Probably one of the last Ultimate Fighters I watched, Tough 8. I think the only one I watched after was like Tough 10 because I had Kimbo. But yeah, I think I tuned out. Okay, anybody who knows me knows I'm very negative when it comes to the Tough series. I check out. I watch as little as possible for tape study if it has to do with my job. I'm tuned out. I'm checked out. But Amir Sadala came on as one of the few, like Matt Mitrione, you know, one of those few 0-0 guys. They came into the UFC 0-0. And granted, it was through the Tough show. But if you look at his run on Tough, which he armbars a guy to get in the house. I forget his name.
CB Dalloway, right?
And no. It's like some guy's no name, but then it's he KOs Gerald Harris. Then he beats Matt Brown, submits CB Dalloway, and he does all those finishes in the last round, which is the third round of the semifinal fight, because they go three for the last match in the Tough House. And it's second round finishes for the Matt Brown and Gerald Harris. So essentially, he draws the only guys who ended up having careers from that show and being champions or contenders in like legitimate organizations: Gerald Harris, Matt Brown, CB Dalloway. And he is just this reluctant, self-deprecating guy, and he gets finishes over all three of them. Then in the finals, meets CB Dalloway again, and they're like, "That was the flukiest win ever. You're not going to get me." Like, CB Dalloway, if people forget, like, submitted Rampage, and they caught it on tape with a Peruvian necktie during one of the practices, and Rampage, you know, laughs it off. And, of course, they air it, so Rampage played it right. But, yeah, CB Dalloway schooled Rampage there in one of the grappling things. And it was just one of the most reluctant winners. And I'm a fan of underdogs. That's why we're doing this. I'm a fan of self-deprecating guys who are, you know, a little more smarter, and you just wouldn't expect them to be in a fight, you know. And he was this guy who was like a dental tech who did a couple Muay Thai bouts at like 205, enters the Ultimate Fighter at 185, when really he's a 170-er who could have made 155 if he were still fighting, and wins the show. He ends up, you know, closing his career at a 6-5 record. I'm not sure what Amir's. I don't know if he's officially retired or what's going on, but yeah, I'd be remiss if I didn't show love to Amir Sadala for that, for his Tough 8 run.
Yeah, his run on Tough was remarkable, because not only did he go out there and finish everyone, but he was up a weight class as well. You know, fought, you know, when he went to the UFC, he was fighting at 170. So to go do that at 185, wasn't it? It was at 185, right? Because CB Dalloway is a middleweight, right? So yes, yeah. So, man, that's pretty impressive in itself. And as far as his personality is concerned, he really kind of reminds me of, like, Forrest Griffin a little bit. So, you know, it was always cool when they had him on, you know, the little shows that they would put on UFC.com and stuff like that back in the day. So, yeah, man, he was cool to watch for sure.
Yeah, he had a great personality. I know he's friends with my buddies over in the Junkie Radio studio. They've done, like, trips to Afghanistan and stuff like that with him. And apparently he's just a class dude, like, through and through. Inside and outside of the octagon, which is always good to hear. Hold on, I'm pulling up the guy he fought to get in the house right now, just because it's gonna drive me. Oh, yeah, that's right, Steve Burns. I know it sounds like that comic Steve Byrne or whatever, that like Korean Irish guy, but yeah, that's who he submitted to get in the house. But yeah, that's my number three. All right, sir, what is your number two, Daniel Levy, number two underdog?
My number two underdog is Robert the Reaper Whittaker. I mean, firstly, at 170, this guy was knocking dudes out and looked incredible. But, you know, he was cutting way too much weight, man. And it's kind of funny, you know, how ignorant I was about weight cutting at the time, because, you know, my philosophy back then was like, well, if he goes up a weight class, you know, he's going to be too small. But little did I know that, look, man, he looks fresher out there. He's faster. His power is translating. And now he's got a an opportunity against Jacare. If he wins this fight, he's going to go out there and get a title shot. He's about to be the underdog again. He was the underdog in almost all of his fights in the middleweight run. You know, obviously the Rafael Natal fight, he wasn't the underdog there, but against Uriah Hall, he was the underdog. Against Derek Brunson, he was the underdog. And yeah, I'm very, very impressed with Robert Whittaker, especially at 185. And back to the point about the weight cutting, man, it's not just him who's had success, you know, up a weight class. You look at a guy like Dustin Poirier, you look at a guy like Kelvin Gastelum, they've been killing it ever since they moved up a weight class. And, you know, they got more water in their brain and their body, you know, they're feeling more healthy out there, they're taking shots better. So I am stoked to see what Robert the Reaper Whittaker does. Is he going to be Australia's first UFC champion?
I think he's got the best chance, but it's hard because I'm a near homer for this guy. I appreciate the Pacific Islanders doing well. I'm not going to lie, but Robert Whittaker, you know, he gained my attention off of the Tough Nations when he came off that, because I actually didn't watch it. But you know, watching him come off that show against Colton Smith and so forth, and seeing kind of his, you know, karate boxing influence, and a guy who came up with karate and boxing first. I'm very partial to these guys that blend those styles, and Robert Whittaker does it uniquely. And you know, I'll be honest, I wasn't confident when I took a shot at him at his first bout at 185, or I should say, you know, back to 185 against Clint Hester. And but that cash, and I've been on him ever since, and it's paid off very well. So, and you know, and another reason why I'm glad you brought him up as well, Daniel, is because, you know, like you said, it's the theme of, which I'm hoping we're going to see more, guys moving up a weight class, and how the odds makers are already kind of counting him out as a negative move. But if you can kind of see between the lines, you can see that there's some value there, right?
100%. And dude, I'm in love with this guy. I mean, look, he bounces around like a karate guy, but he's got the hands of a boxer. Yeah. And, you know, he's a little bit smaller for the weight class, so he's got that speed. The head kicks come out of nowhere. He's able to force you into a brawl with him, where he usually has the upper hand in a brawl. You know, I'm going to say 9 times out of 10, because if you brawl with a guy like Stephen Thompson, you know what's going to happen most of the time. You know, you have to be like Tyron Woodley and stare at him until you get that one opening, you know, 24 minutes into the fight, to bomb on a guy like Steven Wonderboy Thompson. You know what I mean? But Robert Whittaker went out on his shield there, and ever since then, he's been killing dudes. Because like I said, he's able to force you into a brawl. And also, he's very athletic too, man. So, you know, when when people shoot in on him, obviously he's able to stuff the head. He swims in for the double underhooks, and then he's able to pull his leg out. And then dudes get that discouraged look on their face, like, oh, I got to stand with this guy. So, dude, I'm really curious to see if Jacare is going to be shooting across the room. Because obviously, look, Jacare gets you down. There's not a lot of guys that can get up. But I truly believe Robert Whittaker's takedown defense, as at least what we've seen so far, it's looked pretty damn good to me, man. And, you know, people are going to be like, well, who's he fought and this and that. And I don't really like those arguments, because I feel like it discredits the opponent. But look, man, he's shown me good technique in his times that he's attempted to defend takedowns, you know, against guys like Derek Brunson. Yeah. I mean, he did what you're supposed to do. You push the head down. You swim in for the double underhooks. You pull your leg out. I mean, what else is there to do? He's showing the proper technique.
The thing he does the most that I like is that he circles too. And most guys don't do that. They might be able to have the reactionary time to hit the sprawl of the hips and kind of know, you know, what grips to fight and certain. But if you can fight the grips and you know the hips, sometimes it's not enough. You only delay it. You know, we'll see guys break, you know, pop their hips away appropriately, and they'll break a grip, but they kind of freeze, and they'll kind of just like with a punch, you can't go straight back, because if you go back, you might avoid the initial punch. But what happens? You get caught by the second or third punch. Same with the takedown. Even if your hips and your hands are all functioning 100%, if you're sprawling straight back into the cage, you know, it's only going to get you so far. And now all of a sudden you're faced with a different problem, where a lot of guys, they'll break those grips and they'll circle off, because when they don't circle, that's when it's trouble. But Whittaker, what I like, the little detail he does that a lot of even the best, you know, guys with wrestling bases don't do enough, is they don't circle with whatever else they're doing with the takedown defense. But not to get too deep down to that rabbit hole, another reason why I'm glad you like brought up Robert Whittaker, because when guys change weight classes, or if they're small for a weight class, I used to always point to the Frankie Edgar example. I mean, it's easy to point to wrestling, but I point to the Frankie Edgar example. I said, you know, if you're going to be undersized for a weight class, you need wrestling. And that's still true, and that's still arguably number one. But Robert Whittaker has arguably number two for not just what you need to fight small at a weight class, but the whole reason why we're doing this list, what you need to be a good underdog. And that's right, he has that classic Pacific Islander chin and knockout power, and they always come at a solid pair, right? And that's what you want. That's what you want, an underdog, a chin that's going to keep him in the fight, to fight for your money, and the knockout power to put it away no matter what the scorecards say. So yeah, he fits the bill. He hits the check boxes, all right, sir.
Well said, my friend. And look, man, I could sit here, like you said, and talk about this kid for the next hour. Right. So I'm just going to let you go to your number two right now, bro.
My number two is not – again, I feel bad. This is not maybe a guy that I don't think you would – he's been underdog a lot. But I don't think you would have done well, because he's kind of won when he's supposed to win. But this is more just an individual performance. Now, I don't think he's going to be on your list, so I'll kind of step on this one, you know. TJ Dillashaw is amongst one of those names that pop up when you want to look at an individual performance for Henan Barao, obviously. But the guy who gets it on my list is a true underdog, a true Rocky, because like Rocky, he didn't win. And, you know, you can argue, you know, make arguing points. It almost doesn't matter at this point. You just appreciate the fight for what it was. And that is Alexander Gustafsson, the night he met John Jones, who is still, whether you love him or hate him, you know, considered, you know, the greatest champion. He's the one caveat, the one asterisk on. I love DC, and I think he should get more credit in the pound for pound rankings. But yes, John Jones is the one asterisk on DC's record and career, and rights to that title. And Gustafsson gave him the fight of the fight of his life. And you know, you catch me on the right night with enough beer in me, I'll argue that he won that fight. But that's not the point. Now he gets credit regardless for being an underdog. I don't know. I'm not sure if Gustafsson, that performance ranks for you, Mr. Levy, but
– Oh, dude. But listen. I remember exactly where I was when that fight happened. So I was at a concert. I saw Queens of the Stone Age and Arctic Monkeys, and, you know, someone walked up to me and was like, all right, who you got tonight, John Jones or Alexander Gustafsson? I was like, bro, John Jones is going to walk through this guy. Like, just trust me. And the guy was like, nah, man, Gustafsson's got a good chance here. I was like, dude, you're crazy. John Jones is about to destroy him. And apparently John Jones felt the same way too, man, because a word on the street was he barely trained for that fight. You know what I'm saying? He would, like, he'd show up after an all-night bender and, you know what I'm saying, get his reps in that way. But, man, he went in there and he had to go through some adversity, and he really showed his heart, and John Jones got the W. But as far as Gustafsson's concerned, you know, man, like I said, I counted him out in that fight. So the fact that after, you know, the fifth round of that fight, a lot of us were like, did Gustafsson just win? Everyone that was with me in that room thought Gustafsson won at the time. Now, when I've rewatched the fight, I do score it for John Jones now. But at the time, man, I had no clue what they were about to say when the judges' scorecards were going to be read.
Man, me too. I mean, if it wasn't for those, you know, bursts at the end of the round, one of which where he rocked Gustafsson, you could argue that those rounds were going Gustafsson's way too. I mean, that's how close of a fight. I don't think anybody could have said they knew it was going for either guy confidently. I mean, and that's what you want in a fight. I mean, you want upsets, you want thrillers, you want all that. And that fight had it. That was the closest thing I think MMA has had to a Rocky, you know? I mean, John Jones being our Apollo, and at least for that night, Gustafsson was the Rocky.
He did it again when he fought DC too.
That was just the performance alone was just insane. I'm surprised Gustafsson has anything left to give us, to be honest. Like, I'm almost just nervous. And then, you know, his last fight, it felt like he just left parts of himself on the mat in both those fights with DC and Jones. I don't know if we're going to see the same Gus again. And I'm not trying to be negative when I say that. Just being honest.
Oh, yeah. It's a reality of this sport. I mean, this is the hurt business. It's ruthless, man. But we're going to have to wait and find out what the deal is, man. You know, because he's overcame a lot of losses, and he's a tough guy. I know he used his wrestling in his last fight. A lot of us weren't expecting that. We're going to have to see what happens. Does he have a fight book that you know of?
Probably does, and I'm just a blick. I think my head's just kind of a mess right
now. Is he fighting Glover Teixeira?
Yes, I said that was the first thing that came in my head. I didn't want to say if it was confirmed though, but yeah, that's what I think I heard.
Good, that's a good one. That's great.
Oh, that's a great fight. I love that fight. That was one of the few I thought of like before. But yeah, man. Let's go to our number one here. Number one. I'm excited to hear yours, man. I'm excited to hear what your number one underdog is.
Any guesses?
Ah, if it's the one you were leaning toward.
No, that's for honorable mentions.
Okay, that's for honorable mentions. Okay, I won't say that then. I have no guess then. That was my only guess I had.
My number one underdog pick is Yoel Romero. I mean, this guy, firstly, he's like 8-0 in the UFC. He might be 9-0 at this point, but I believe he's 8-0 in the UFC. And I mean, talk about a freak athlete, dude. And what's so interesting about him is his mindset more than his physical attributes. You know, it kind of seems to me like, you know, he has an affinity for finishing fights in the third round. And it's like he takes a little breaks and feels you out a little bit. But once he's ready, man, he explodes on dudes in a way where, like, you know, he bounces around like Machida, but he's got a different kind of knockout power. Obviously, his wrestling is Olympic level. I mean, you've seen the clip of him ankle picking that dude. I mean, you saw the fight with Chris Weidman, the way he took down Weidman. One does not simply ragdoll Weidman like that. I know Luke Rockhold finished Weidman, but they had a spirited battle before Weidman threw that infamous spinning wheel kick. But with Romero, man, Romero felt him out for a round, and then he threw that big body kick, and then he started tossing him around, and then that third round comes out there 20 seconds in, the flying knee knocks him out. Yoel Romero is a guy that you consider him a long-term investment. You bet on him every single fight because you know that, like I said, long-term investment, it pays off to bet on a guy like that. Let's say he loses his next fight. You still won the last eight, so it's no big deal, man. And he's a long-term winner. So he's my number one underdog pick because he always finds a way to win.
Man, that's another guy that – it's crazy because if you think of it, like recently, the recent work, I think more people have caught on now, especially after the Weidman fight. But it's hard because you think explosive guy, powerful, like what's an underdog about that? But you think about his age and the miles he has on his body and just the mathematics of him even being there in the first place. It's pretty astounding the fact that he's been able to stay competitive, you know, and then take these long breaks in between fights, take on, you know, real tough guys, even some of them that are tough before people knew they were tough, like Derek Brunson, and, you know, eating those head kicks. And things that you're like, okay, well, he lasted this long, but we've seen him get taxed. We've seen the end come near. He's losing rounds. He's essentially losing all the fights that he's winning. Like, we've seen this before in MMA. This only lasts so long, and he keeps proving us and the odds makers wrong. And although he might not be the underdog if he ever gets the fight with Michael Bisping, he has – I don't have the numbers in front of me, but he has been an underdog for a considerable amount of his bouts, surprisingly. People might not think this, but he actually has. So – thinking that he's paid off, that is very true. He paid off big for me last time because not only did I play him inside the distance because that was my official pick, but I only play about one round three flyer a fight just for fun, and I'm only putting a quarter unit. Like, it's just fun, right? And
he's always the dog.
Yeah. I was like, oh, third round finish. It was a no brainer for that card who to play it on. And then I felt so bad because I said this on the MMA Latest Roundtable. We're doing year end awards for top. For KO of the year, and I was like, for years as a Rogan fan, I would hear Rogan refer to Rampage and Arona to like, oh, that's the fight where I thought somebody got killed, and I tuned in like just after as an MMA fan, just after that happened, so I missed that, right? So for like this whole decade as an MMA fan, I've been waiting for my Rampage Arona moment, and I finally got it with Weidman Romero, and I regretted it. I'm like, poor Weidman, he's gone.
It was vicious, man. It was brutal.
It was vicious.
And it's not just against a guy like Chris Weidman, you know, a former UFC world champion that he's counted out against. I mean, he was an underdog to Brad Tavares, to Lyoto Machida, to Jacare, and then obviously Chris Weidman too. And there's some other ones in there as well, man. And yeah, always counted out. Obviously, none of us think he's going to be counted out against the champ Michael Bisping at this point, because Michael is another underdog, you know, that if you cash in on that Luke Rockhold, I'm not one of those people that bet him there. But, man, I wish I was, right? No, but Michael Bisping, man, you got to give that guy a lot of credit because you talk about an underdog career, and this is a guy that not a lot of people would have came back from that first Dan Henderson knockout. I'll tell you that right now.
Yep.
And it didn't just stop there, Dan. You know, he had all kinds of setbacks. You know, the Wanderlei Silva fight, the Rashad Evans fight, the first Luke Rockhold fight, the Vitor Belfort fight, the Chael Sonnen fight. He had to overcome all those defeats, and now he's holding the UFC world title. So as far as a career perspective, and this, I wasn't even supposed to talk about this guy, but we got into it because he's going to be an underdog here against Yoel Romero. And obviously I do favor Romero, and back to Romero, you know, he had to work his way up to being the favorite because he was counted out in all of his fights in his run. But yeah, Michael Bisping as a career underdog, I mean, shit, man, he defines it, bro.
You know, I know.
He wears it.
both those names are relevant to my number one in the sense of Michael Bisping, you're right, is his absolute career underdog. I mean, yeah, throughout his whole career, but even like non-devastating losses like to Tim Kennedy, I thought he was broken to the fact where I went from I faded him and played CB Dalloway against him just for the odds and the numbers. I mean, I wasn't like, you know, tied to that, like married to that, but it was just to give it for instance of how much of an underdog the narrative was different. Just not even, you know, just not even a couple years ago in Bisping's career. And then even though, like you said, I wish I was one who was on him, but I was on Rockhold. But I did pick Bisping against Anderson Silva, which, you know, which wasn't the hugest underdog, but wasn't the most popular pick. But it just goes to show you how crazy of a career, you know, that guy had. And he almost made my number one for that, because my number one definitely for me, it had to be a career perspective underdog, because those are like the fighters that I kind of are just personally most drawn to. I'm always drawn to the underdogs in anything, in any sport, any competition. But this one is more toward Yael Romero in the sense of this was a world-class Olympic wrestler who is old for MMA. And yes, Randy Couture has to be my number one underdog, man. From doing his first fight at age 33, like the aforementioned Joe Warren, who started this list, so did Randy Couture. And just, you know, that story where the cage closes behind him and he was just a wrestling coach who saw this stuff on VHS tapes because his buddy Don Fry talked him into it. And he's like, what have I done? You know, what have I done? And he uses smartness to become one of the most craftiest guys to find ways to win. Despite, you know, being balding before he ever started his career, he didn't give a fuck. He just went in there, kicked ass. That first Vitor Belfort fight was so crazy. Like, Vitor Belfort was Tyson. Like, all the one-round Vitor tropes, or if you get past the first round, like, that knowledge wasn't out there. Vitor was just Tyson up until this point. Like, Vitor wasn't the Vitor of today. There wasn't those telltales, like, didn't start happening yet of submission losses, under preparation. Like, no, like, he was like, this was heavyweight Vitor, where he had no neck. Randy Couture had the, go pull this up on Fight Pass. Randy Couture had the knee sleeves and the wrestling shoes on. This was this day in the UFC. And he just wears him down and just beats Vitor down in a dirty boxing clinch and just really shows you the importance of the clinch in MMA. You know, you fast forward, you know, it was underdog against Liddell, beats Liddell. Sure, he would then lose his rematch and subsequent fight, which had him retire. But then comes back and fights Tim Sylvia. This is about where I started, like, becoming a real, like, hardcore, where I actually, like, knew what was going on in the scene. And he was not giving, you know, you make fun of Tim Sylvia now. Again, retrospect, hindsight 2020. Tim Sylvia was, you know, was still made fun of, but he was also still considered the baddest man on the planet because no one could beat him at the time, at least in the UFC. You know, there were people in Japan, of course, but no one could beat him. And certainly no one gave Randy Couture a shot. Didn't matter he was coming back in Ohio where he wrestled collegiately. Didn't matter what the crowd said. He wasn't going to do this. And he comes and does the inside leg kick overhand, drops Tim Sylvia, takes the heavyweight title. And then by this time I start training at Extreme Couture. And I remember, like, people, like, almost like, you know, not people like, I mean, just friends of mine, like, not people in the know or coaches or anything, but people going, oh my God, Randy's training for Gonzaga. A little nervous for him, you know, like, people were, like, nervous. Even, like, staunch supporters of Randy were nervous for his health going into this Gabe Gonzaga fight. And you just see Gabe Gonzaga, who, by the way, just, now you want to talk about upsets and underdogs, just head kick knocked out Mirko Kokop, right? Next, you know, smash cut, he's got blood in his eye, he's getting grinded against the cage, he's mentally breaking, crying to the ref, going, I have blood in my eye, I can't see. And Randy Couture is just bullying the shit out of him. And then just takes him down, breaks his nose. And Randy Couture is doing this with a broken arm because one of Gabe Gonzaga's kicks that I just aforementioned broke Randy Couture's arm. I mean, he's just muscling this guy. I mean, from start to finish, you want to talk about underdogs, career perspective, individual performances. I mean, this guy's got like an M60 machine gun chain full of ammunition of these experiences. I know Extreme Couture. I know Randy, and I know his son Ryan, but I'm sorry, even if the biases weren't there, Randy Couture is number one on my list for underdogs.
You never got to apologize for picking a guy like Randy Couture. I mean, this is Captain America we're talking about, you know yes. what I mean? And I mean, the way he would break dudes was just unlike anything I've ever seen before in my life. And obviously he was, you can make the argument, he was the inventor of the, you know, dirty boxing in MMA, you know what I mean? Those uppercuts in the clinch. He was one of the first dudes to really bring that to the UFC, man. And, you know, and then later on in his career, I know he dropped that fight to Nogueira, but the performance he put on so much heart in that fight. I mean, he could have tapped out on multiple occasions. He could have covered up and let the ref intervene many times in that fight, but he didn't, man. And there's a reason that the Portland, Oregon crowd was up on their feet at the end of that fight. You know, it was that was a true fight of the night. That was one of those times where I was like, man, I wish this main event was five rounds. You know what I'm saying, dude? And then, you know, later on when Mark Munoz fought Chris Leben, that was the first time that a main event was, you know, five rounds, non-title fight, obviously. But, man, I really wish Nogueira versus Couture was five rounds now, don't you?
Me too, man. I'm getting all these goosebumps with you mentioning it. I'm glad you mentioned that fight because that, when you think about it in retrospect, first of all, Randy Couture looked great physically in that fight as well. Like, that was one of the last times where we definitely saw Randy Couture, in my opinion, where I think that was the last good performance from him. I know he won fights after that, technically. Right, you know the band.
Oh, the James Toney one was pretty fucking good.
James Toney, right? But that was the last like good performance, and you could maybe even make that argument. I think no, because Brendan Schaub happened after that, but you could almost make that argument for Nogueira. That was one of his last best performances. And my coach Neil Melanson was actually brought in. That's how I met him, and he was actually brought in to Extreme Couture and got his coaching spot from that fight because they brought in Neil specifically because he had a. Nogueira, he had that style and that guard repertoire and if you remember in the countdown episode for Neil's part, like Neil talks about it, he goes, Nogueira was my favorite grappler of all time. Like I studied his game. I knew that's why they brought me into this camp because they know that no one knows his game better than me as far as and so they brought him in as a specialist and he ended up getting a coaching spot and that man is responsible for teaching me and. Probably why I'm able to even do my breakdowns the way I do it. So, kind of a little crazy piece of history there, but yeah, man, that was really cool. Before we get to our honorable mentions, I'm going to pull up some lists from Twitter and Facebook. But if you want to kind of give away, like, if there's anything at the top of your honorable mentions list, Daniel, if you want to let the listeners know, go ahead and let us know that one now. If you had like a top honorable mentions before we get to the rest of them.
Definitely, and because, you know, at first I did a top five honorable mentions, but then there were a couple that I just had to add to the list. So absolutely, let's get into those first. So Tyron Woodley, man, I mean, look, he's the UFC welterweight champion, and he's usually the underdog most of the time. And it's because, you know, you look at some of his performances, and there are a lot of times where, you know, it does take time for the action to materialize. But there's a reason behind that. You know, what's the number one mistake you can make against a high-level karate guy? In my opinion, Dan, it's getting frustrated and trying to rush him and throw big bombs at him because you're going to get countered. You look at a fight like Ryan Bader versus Lyoto Machida, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. You know, Ryan Bader lost his cool. He charged at Lyoto Machida, and he got slipped. So if you make that mistake against a guy like Stephen Wonderboy Thompson, I don't care who you are, you're getting put down. So with T. Wood, I give him so much credit because he had to wait for that one opportunity to blitz Stephen Wonderboy Thompson. And like I said earlier on the show, he didn't get that opportunity until 24 minutes into the fight. I mean, that shows me so much patience and poise. And he was like, all right, here's the chance to do it. I'm going to do it. Because before, look, if he would have tried to blitz him before, it wouldn't have worked, man. The opening wasn't there. But finally, when he saw it, he went for it, and he won the fight, man. So, yeah. And also, he's been an underdog in a lot of his fights. And I know that there were a couple of, you know, off performances here and there, the Rory McDonald fight, the Jake Shields fight, where he kind of dropped the ball. But in my opinion, his hard work is paying off, man. And dudes are scared to stand with this guy, man. I mean, like, you know the deal. I mean, he dropped Wonderboy like four times within their series. Maybe five or six, honestly. Obviously, one does not simply knock out Robbie Lawler. I mean, the last man to do that before T. Wood was Nick Diaz. That was over a decade ago. You know what I mean? So Woodley's got crazy power. And, you know, he doesn't like when people talk about his athleticism because he feels like it discredits his hard work. But the dude's absolutely a hard worker. But, I mean, he also does have natural gifts. So what I like to call him is a tactical freak athlete because – he is a freak athlete. You can't write that off. You can't act like that's not true. But he's smart. He's tactical. And the Stephen Wonderboy Thompson fight, even though it is kind of boring to the casual eye, I understand what he was doing there, man. He was waiting for that opportunity. So that's a tactical freak athlete, man.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if people were slow to come around on Woodley, don't feel bad because I was. But I think more people are realizing, you know, coming around to his game and realizing the intelligence behind it. I know I have. And I've respected him for stuff in and out of the cage more and more. But I'm glad you put him on there. A definite underdog in many ways. And we're going to jump right now to our submissions in transition segment, where using the hashtag Protect Your Neck Podcast, you can also submit to the list that we're talking about now. And my man, Gabe Killian from Oddsbreaker, I'm familiar with Gabe there. He submitted some as far as like underdog plays. Home Rousey, that's definitely an obvious one, but a good one. Anybody who was on that, props. Frankie Sines and Alcantara was one that he was particularly big on for him. Thiago Santos over Ronnie Marks. Eric Spicely over Thiago Santos. Oh, bad flashbacks there for me. Spicely over Santos. That one hurt me back when that happened. And then, of course, yeah, Darren Elkins, who he was on my honorable mentions list for a performance against Mirsad Bektik. That was, I mean, you could put Darren Elkins for career underdog probably too, because he's got that style, right?
Yeah.
But yeah.
Those are some good. Those are some good plays, man. And you know what? There's one that he left off. And since we're talking about, you know, your best underdog hits.
Yes.
My best underdog hit to this day.
Yes.
Is Johnny Eduardo +750.
Oh yeah.
Against Eddie Wineland.
Gosh.
You know, and it was interesting. I was surprised about the line. I'll tell you why, man. And I'm not trying to be, you know, Mr. After the Fact or any shit like that.
Right. No,
but
no.
Look. I mean, since we're on the topic, let's talk about it, man. So he was +750, and I found it interesting because we know with Wineland, you know, even though he's obviously got knockout power, he does keep his chin straight up in the air, and he keeps his hands down, and he's able to bully dudes. But when you're talking about a guy like Johnny Eduardo, who's Nova Uniao's striking coach, you know, he's Jose Aldo, Marlon Sandro, Henan Barao's striking coach. You know, you better keep your hands up and your chin down against that guy. It was just a bad stylistic matchup. And, Johnny Eduardo made him pay, and he knocked him out stiff in the first round, man.
Fuck it, eh? No, yeah, that major props to you on that one, man. Yes, definitely. That is a huge play, not just for the number, but, yeah, I mean, even at the time, if you're familiar with the bantamweight division at this time or either of those two fighters, that is definitely a big pickup. And again, while we're on the topic, it's great. I guess this one is the one that almost made my list on the 11th hour here. But as far as play goes, and probably one of my best plays, and shout out to my homie Brian Schoonover, who y'all have heard here on the After Party editions. This is both of our biggest plays because this fight, we bet on it multiple times because it was supposed to happen multiple times. And that was Fabricio Werdum versus Cain Velasquez. And we couldn't believe the price of the underdog Werdum was. You know, for me, technically, just kind of breaking it down in the clinch and seeing the things that I saw there and just the improvements of the Muay Thai to, you know, the end game of who's more of a game over game as far as, you know, grinding on the floor to the submission threat. And I just couldn't believe, you know, I think we're getting +4 to +4 to 1 to 5 to 1 odds in the initial opener for the first time. Injury happens, so he fights, you know, Werdum fights Hunt, so he has one training camp in the books. He wins that fight against Hunt. The next fight is scheduled, yes, once again, Mexico City. He goes out there early, and we're like, oh, he already has a training camp in the books. We already gave him the edge. Oh, what? Plus, I think it was like +350 or something. So me and Brian, we played it heavy. I think we put like $50 a piece, which is a lot of money for us. We usually don't bet that heavy. So, and this is like the early days. I didn't have mixed martial analysts up. I was doing everything on paper still. And I was like, all right, let's play this one. And then it was one of those fights where we go back like a week later, and he texts me while he's at work, like, hey, man, the line's still the same. I double dipped, and then I'm like, oh, you son of a bitch. And then I'd come back with a text like, hey, man, Kane's not going out there early, and Werdum is. I double dipped, and we at least double dipped. I can't speak for him, but we both at least double dipped on that line more than one occasion. So it was one of those ones that we were just so excited, and when it finally we were just, you know, the whole high fives, I took the money and took my girl to a nice anniversary, like, said, baby, don't thank me. Thank Fabricio Werdum. And that was one of my favorite like underdog plays ever, probably, just because it was just really fun, amateurish.
Nice, man. That was a great play. And you know, at the time, Cain was really looking unstoppable. You know, a lot of people could make the argument that he was the greatest heavyweight of all time, at least back then. You know what I mean?
Yes.
But it's crazy how things change. You know, and since I said greatest heavyweight of all time, man. During Junior Cigano's run from his knockout win over Fabricio Werdum to his knockout win over Frank Mir, whole run, dude, that's one of the greatest. That's one of the greatest heavyweight runs
that's
in
amazing.
UFC history.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And but another reason why I brought up that fight, though, not just to you know, brag about an underdog pick or anything like that. But, you know, you're right. King was looking unstoppable. But I think, you know, betting-wise, the bigger picture or takeaway from that fight is – I'm not blaming that fight, but right around that fight, we saw a change in the odds and the general information, right? Where this whole era we've been going by for so long, where the wrestler always has an advantage, and if it's a wrestler who's got, you know, an undefeated or near undefeated record, you know, all these typical tropes that the odds makers and the general public, you know, bet heavy, right? We would see, oh, roll wrestler, you know, any kind of stylistic intangible matchup versus matchup. We're all siding blindly to the wrestler. And for Kane, it helped even support his already impressive record of TKOs and his run to the title, right? And it all fit that narrative. And I love that narrative because now we've kind of saw what we've seen, especially as the game has evolved. It's not about that. Like the wrestlers, it's not a done and done deal because now we're seeing strikers with no wrestling background have learned how to defend takedowns. Like we were just talking about the Robert Whittaker. You were just waving that flag, correct? We're seeing that's not so much an anomaly anymore. And we've seen the odds. This is not just my opinion here, because let's be honest, I think the odds have reflected my opinion. We're not seeing wrestlers, even wrestlers that maybe should be favored to win the fight, they're not being automatically opened as 3-1 favorites anymore. You know what I'm saying? I think those days are gone. There's still bad lines. There's still matches. There's still territories that I know you yourself, sir, have your theories about for sure. And we're definitely battling those territories as degenerates ourselves. But I think that trope of the wrestler beats all and all be all, I think that's going away. And that around
oh, hell yeah.
that fight, it started turning, dude. I think.
Here's the thing with that, man, is that nowadays these kids, you know, they don't have wrestling backgrounds. They don't have karate backgrounds. They have MMA backgrounds. Yes. And they're good at everything, you know, from the start. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not saying their first day in class are good at everything. I'm saying that they learn everything. You know, yep. they don't just learn one style at a time, man. So, absolutely. Yeah, you got to look out for these new kids, man. It's serious. And obviously the lines have reflected that because a lot of these fights nowadays are lined a lot closer. And also, another point we were talking about earlier was the new judging and the new scoring criteria.
Yes,
and I feel like that's going to favor less wrestlers unless the wrestler does a lot of damage.
Absolutely. And judges are – I mean, refs are also being a little more educated with their stand-ups, though obviously there's bad stand-ups every card. But while we're on Verdum and speaking on this mission to transitions, let's go to the next person. John Rico, shout-out to my man John. His first on his list is a Verdum pick, but it was Verdum over Fedor. Boy, do I wish I was gambling back then. I mean, I said I wish I was gambling back when Randy Couture was fighting because that would have made probably both of us some pretty pennies, old Randy Couture plays. But he had Verdum over Fedor, Scott Smith over Kung Lee. Oh, man, that was a
damn,
underdog a fight one, right man. There. That was a great fight.
That's a good one.
That was just a great, like, underdog fight, right? And then he had Sokoju over Little Nog, got Love for Pride. That was a
– dude. There was a little while there where Scott Smith would just come back in these fights after ridiculous whoopings. Obviously, the Pete Sell fight, that's an infamous knockout. I mean, the body shot. And then after the fight, you know, when he knocks him out with that right, and then he's on the ground still cringing from that liver shot that he took. And then obviously the Kung Lee fight, man. He was getting worked that entire fight, and then he found a way to win at the end, man. That was awesome.
Yeah, I said upsets might be a little too narrow, but – I think comeback is a doable narrow list. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
Scott Smith would be on the comeback list. And then John Rico.
Frank Yeager, too.
Oh, yeah. John Rico also, his last two were Paulo Thiago over Koscheck. Good one.
Yeah.
And this one almost.
That's some OG shit.
Oh, that's OG. Speaking of OG, this one almost made my list. Brian Bowles over Miguel Torres. I mean, you want to talk about beating the streak. Miguel Torres had some ridiculous streak at the time. So great pick. What's up?
Brian Bowles is a Georgia boy, and, you know, I saw him recently at the local fights. The dude, you know, because you heard what went down in the news, you know, a couple years back. The dude was looking good, man. He's got his life back together, and looks like he's got a good head on his shoulders again. And, you know, I hope to see him back fighting again one day.
Dude, that is good to hear. That actually is really good to hear. I like hearing the fighters, you know, at least on the positive trajectory because, you know, you hear these really bad stories afterwards. But, Johnny Mack, Jonathan McDonald. He has, of course, Matt Serra over GSP. That's a classic. You got to have that. TJ Dillashaw versus Henan Barao, which we touched on. Emmanuel Newton over King Mo. That's a good one. Great pull there. That's a good one. Wow, the spinning back fist. You know, you were talking about Frankie Edgar, Levy. He has Frankie Edgar over BJ Penn. That is a classic upset right there. I mean, people were interviewing BJ Penn like he already won the fight. I remember before that in Abu Dhabi.
Not only sorry to interrupt.
No, please interrupt.
Not only was that an unbelievable upset, but You want to talk about an unbelievable underdog, you know, comeback performance. How about, you know, the second and third grade Maynard fights where he gets 10-7 in the first round both times. And then he comes back. And in my opinion, you know, that second fight was a draw. I thought Frankie won that fight. And then the third one, you know, he left no doubt. He went out there and he finished him, man. So that you talk about underdog performances. That's one of them right there.
Dude, you're just making me want to do a comeback list because, like, career perspective within the fight, like, you can get real creative with, like, top five comebacks in MMA. So thanks for that idea, Mr. Levy. But his last one was – this was a good one, a good one for the ladies. Horatia Tiburcio when she beat Michelle Waterson.
Oh, man. Don't remind me.
Sorry. That's right. But, yeah. And then I got to give Jersey Mike, Oklahoma Knowles, a.k.a. Jersey Mike, some love. Frankie Edgar career. And, you know, obviously the guy like Jersey Mike, he's going to be representing Tom River. But I got love for Jersey. So good pick there. Great pick with Frankie Edgar. Sarah over GSP, okay, yep, absolutely. Weidman over the Spider, that's a classic. Holly over Ronda.
I was
Ronda.
There, man. It hurt.
Ooh, you were at Weidman over Spider?
I was at that fight, the first one where Weidman knocked him out, and Silva, you know, he was 16-0 in the UFC at the time, and dude, it was insane. The whole place went silent when he got knocked out. It was unlike anything I've ever seen before in my life. And I've been to plenty of UFC events, but you know, when you're talking about a guy like Anderson Silva, you know, while the fight was going on and he was taunting him, I was like, bro, he's breaking him. You know, he's about to fuck him up and this and that. And then when Chris Weidman landed that big left hook, like, you could hear a pin drop at the MGM Grand, man. And yeah, dude, that moment changed the sport forever.
Man, I wish I could have been at that one. That's crazy. All right, and one more submission here. This is my man, Wan Lee Tran. Oh, that's a good one. Maurice Smith over Mark Coleman. That almost made my top five KO list there. That was a good one. Ray Mercer over Tim Sylvia. Remember that one?
Of course.
And then Melvin Manhoff over Mark Hunt. Yeah, first guy to stop Mark Hunt. Wow. Zoila LaFrosto versus Megumi Fujii. Yeah, that's right. Yep. And, Joe Lozon versus Jens Pulver. Deep pull, Wan Lee Tran. I love that. Lozon versus Pulver, and then ends up, you know, getting coached opposite against him on the Tough Five series. Wow,
that was sick, man! What a way to was that Joe's UFC debut?
That was his debut.
Man, I mean, what a way to make a debut! Obviously, he was counted out there, and then what you mentioned about Tough was pretty funny too.
Yeah, he was back working a computer job the Monday after he knocks out Jens Pulver. It's just crazy. And shouts to Joe Lozon there. All right, anything else on your honorable mention list before we get out of here?
Oh, yeah, I got a couple, bro.
Go ahead, brother, go ahead.
Neil Magny.
Oh,
how come no one's talked about this guy? I mean, look, talk about an underdog. There was a stretch there where he had like a 7 or 8 fight win streak, and, you know, he was a dog in a lot of those fights. And, you know, one conversation that we should talk about is, you know, everyone gets caught in MMA, and certain guys are chinny, but no matter what, everyone's going to get caught eventually. There's only a select few who escape the sport without getting knocked out. You know, you think about a guy like Chris Lytle. He's like one of the only I can think of off the top of my head. But with Neil Magny, you know, he does tend to get hit a lot early in that first round. But if he can overcome, you know, he's one of these dudes that he's got the longest reach in the UFC welterweight division, but he uses that reach. He fights tall. Not everyone that's tall uses their length and their reach, and Neil Magny does that very, very well. And, man, he really fights behind his jab and also
– sorry to interrupt, Daniel. I'm just going to say real quick, the reason why I'm agreeing that Neil Magny's a good underdog is because he's, like, top of the list of, like, guys I've picked wrong lists as far as, like, picks. So you were definitely hitting on a lot of topics as far as, like, you know, reasons as far as, like, why this guy's the underdog. But I'm sorry to interrupt you, man. If I didn't ruin your train of thought already, please continue on Neil Magny on why he's on top of your honorable mentions list.
I mean, you're so right, dude. And I think the reason that he's often counted out is because he's one of these guys that – you know, he came into the UFC off tough, and obviously he wasn't a finished product yet. I mean, you watched him on The Ultimate Fighter getting knocked out by a guy like Mike Ricci, and, you know, you're thinking to yourself, yeah, it's not going to really work out for him. But then, you know, he's one of these resilient guys who just keeps getting better every single fight, and he takes his setbacks like a man, comes back, bounces back every single time, man, no matter how devastating the setback is. He's very mentally strong, but I really, you know, respect the fact that, you know, he tries to implement his game and he gets better at his game every single time, which I mentioned, you know, fighting tall, using that jab, but also he's able to take dudes down from time to time. He's able to weather storms from time to time. And also when he got taken down from by Johnny Hendricks, he was attacking off his back, which showed me that he improved in that area of the game as well. So Neil Magny's always making improvements, and I'm excited to see who he fights next.
Dude, that's awesome. Let me fire back with you along the same line, since we're going down honorable mentions. And now, like I said, I love talking like the gambling perspective of these underdogs, because I feel it's a real important point. And anybody who listens to, you know, your podcast, obviously, or even when I do the breakdown podcast, you'll know that that's definitely a perspective that we always kind of have in mind when we're breaking down a fight. So one of mine is Diego Sanchez, just because. He is, you know, I guess I'll tie him together with Rick Story, because they're both along the similar ilk to me, where they're two guys where my favorite underdogs are durable southpaws who can wrestle. If I had to narrow it down to three generalizations and stereotypes, durable southpaws who can wrestle, there's a lot of great underdogs that come to that list. And the top of mine are guys like Rick Story and Diego Sanchez. And whether you're fans of their styles or not, I wasn't a big fan of Diego Sanchez's style for a long, long time. But then as a kind of a gambler, I've learned to appreciate his style and what it's good for, instead of getting mad at these upsets, starting realizing, well, why are these bad decisions and upsets always happening with Diego? And it's because of his style. And granted, kind of a point that, you know, Daniel's alluded to a couple times in this podcast, which is something we all should keep in mind, that the judging and scoring criteria is changing, and so is the conduction of the referees within the octagon. But generally speaking, forward pressure, a guy that can decide where the fight, it goes down to the ground or stays standing, and he can take a punch. These are all generally good things, no matter what the rule set is, though. So those are kind of, when you're looking for underdogs, those are definitely good stereotypes. If you're not like, well, I don't know if I can tell the techniques, like, you know, and get too deep into splitting the hairs. If you want to keep it simple and stereotype in a positive way, that's not, there's no good stereotype. It's not going to work, you know, 9, 8, 7, 10 times out of 10, but your odds are going to be good when you like those kind of fighters.
You know what's a very underrated Diego Sanchez fight?
Yeah.
The Martin Kamen fight.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Dude,
that was a war, man. And, you know, I've watched that fight 100 times, and I still score it differently every single time I watch it. Like, sometimes I'm like 29-28 Kamen. Other times I'm like 29-28 Diego. So, you know, one of those fights that, again, just like Couture versus Nogueira, you wish it was a five-round main event. So thank you, UFC, for finally implementing a five-round non-title main events, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And another good callback for that fight, something to another good reason to reflect on Kampman versus Sanchez, is that was the golden era, man. I mean, you want to talk about, you know, the WNIMG and how it's kind of depressing and where they're going. And I don't want to take that conversation and really, like, launch down that rabbit hole, per se. But one of my issues is just, like, we don't see the, you know, the commissions, or, you know, the fight game's brutal, or the commissions are dumb, or the judges are stupid. But we would see the UFC in the Zuffa era, they would reach into their own pocket and handle situations and at least try to make things right, whether it was the matchmakers matching guys up like they're coming off a win when they knew they were robbed off the judges, and even paying guys win bonuses. And if you remember in that fight, I believe it was either 70 or 100K each he gave both.
Yeah.
Martin Kampman and Diego Sanchez, because he didn't want to over reward one guy because he felt Kampman, you know, should have got the decision because it was a great fight. So he just pays both guys out of pocket, and we're never going to hear those stories again, and it really bums me out. So I think it's important to look back at those gems in history and appreciate that era, you know, for what it was.
100%, man. Well said.
Any other gems on your list, sir?
Yes, sir. I got a few more. Max Blessed Holloway, another guy similar to Neil Magny in the sense that, you know, he is a little bit taller for the weight class, and, you know, he has had to go through his learning spurts, man. But man, he shows so much potential. And one common theme that he's had throughout his entire career, whether he was the green guy that fought Justin Lawrence, or he's, you know, the seasoned guy now who's the first man in MMA history to finish Anthony Showtime Pettis, he's always been super mentally tough. He's always had that Hawaiian spirit about him. You know how those Hawaiians are, man. They come – there's something in the air over there, man. Those dudes come to fight every single time. So Max has always had that spirit, but he's also a very smart fighter, man. I mean, the way he goes in and out with his movement. You know, what's interesting about him is that he fights like a tall fighter, but he actually has a really short reach for the weight class. He actually only has a 68-inch reach, but he fights like he has a 75-inch reach, man. And, you know, he's also one of these guys similar to Tyron Woodley, you know, not in the sense that there's low output, but similar in the sense that if he sees that one opening and you start to, you know, you start to cower a little bit, this kid is going to unload on you in a way where you might not recover. And then he mixes it up to the body. Then a spinning back kick comes out of nowhere. Then you start shooting on him and he's high elbow guillotining you. You know what I mean? So this kid, Max Bless Holloway, I mean, he's about to fight Jose Aldo. And I'm very intrigued by that matchup. I'm questioning, you know, is Max going to come out southpaw for this one? Because we know traditionally, if you're an orthodox fighter that likes to get off on your leg kicks, it's kind of fucking hard to kick against a southpaw, man. I mean, a few times ago when Jose Aldo fought a southpaw, I know last time, he got one punch by McGregor in 13 seconds. But the time previous to that, when he fought Korean Zombie, there's a reason that he didn't get off on his kicks. And I didn't understand why at the time, but, you know, then you rewatch it, you see him throw that one kick, Zombie checks it, Aldo breaks his foot, he turns into a wrestler, and you know, the reason why was because, you know, he broke his foot trying to kick against a southpaw. So I'm curious if Max comes out in that southpaw stance, and I'm also curious what's going to happen as the fight progresses, because Aldo historically has been known to fade late, and Max is known for his great cardio. So I'm saying, if Max can weather that storm, man, he might put Aldo away, you know, towards the later part of that fight. I'm very intrigued by the matchup. You can never count out a legend like Jose Aldo, arguably the best 145er of all time. Such a sharp, you know, such a sharp striker, man. I mean, that left hook to the liver and right leg kick combo that he does, his signature move, absolutely unbelievable. He's so dynamic. But with Max Holloway, he's always the underdog. He's the underdog here as well. I'm very intrigued to see what he does here, man.
Yeah, man, it's crazy. I mean, even though Max hasn't been the underdog for the last half of this recent run, winning run, but yeah, man, you're right. The stage is set for him to kind of once again return to that role, you know, that he started in with the UFC, being the young gun, forcing there Dustin Poirier, and now even though he's got this, pardon me, he's amassed this crazy winning streak, he's still going to find himself in the underdog in more ways than one. Even if the odds didn't say he was underdog, you know. He's going against one of the greats here, Jose Aldo. Don't let the 13-second McGregor loss, you know, fool you. Jose Aldo is still Jose Aldo. And although I'm a little biased as a, you know, Hawaiian myself, but, you know, my early lean, though, is Max for that. Because if, you know, Holloway, you know, again, I have to look into it. My pick could change. I pick against my favorite fighters all the time. But, you know, that's my thing, you know, in this underdog spirit, is that if Jose doesn't put him away in the beginning, then it kind of leaves room for those fighters that have that fighter's will to come through at the end. And when you're dealing with a fighter who is a little suspect in the later rounds, which, you know, I believe is fair to say, you know, it's hard to say because, you know, Aldo doesn't have that many weaknesses, but that's definitely one you can point to. And yeah, man, we're in for a fun fight, that's for sure. But one of my quintessential underdogs, which I thought you were going to say earlier, as far as a guy, okay, this guy has been an underdog in 6 out of his 8 last fights. He's a quintessential underdog as far as, like, he doesn't fit the wrestler thing or the southpaw thing or anything like that, but he fits the Jeremy Stevens thing. That's right. It's Jeremy fucking Stevens. This guy has been an underdog in 6 out of his 8 last fights, and this is arguably, like, the better part of his career when he moved to Alliance, cutting, you know, fighting at 145, having some of his best performances. I mean, he was even the underdog to Hani Jason. The only two fighters in his last 8 fights he was a favorite, he was only a slight favorite to, and that was Darren Elkins and, wow, now the name's slipping. Oh, Charles Oliveira. Those were the only, and he was slight favorites at best in those fights. He was underdogs in 6 out of his last 8 fights. He is the durable guy who has knockout power to the third round, kind of like Yoel Romero we were talking about earlier, Levy. And he's got that knockout power, that chin, that fighter spirit. He is that quintessential underdog where he gets announced as an underdog and you're like, okay, that makes sense. But then you're also like, if someone were to play him, you'd be like, okay, that makes sense too. Because he's always live. I don't know. Does Jeremy Stevens rank up there for your underdog list as a gambler?
Dude, Jeremy Stephens is always one punch away from changing the tide of the fight, and you can never deny that. And also, you know, even though he is one of those guys that, you know, it's one shot at a time and he doesn't really have a lot of volume, he makes that one shot count. And not only that, all areas of his game have improved. Like, you watched that fight with Frankie Edgar, and even though he didn't get the decision, I mean, he got up from pretty much every single takedown and showed a lot of improvements in that area of his game. And yeah, man, I mean, he had that big upset over Henan Barrow, you know, back in the day when he knocked out Marcus Davis. Yeah, Jeremy Stephens is a badass, dude.
Yeah, man, definitely. I'm kind of looking over my honorable mentions list now. Aside from the obvious ones, everything's kind of been already mentioned. You know, I will say some fun ones, like, you know, Fabio Maldonado or Kaito Nakamura are fun ones. Brian Barberena, who is probably one of my best underdog plays of last year, because he's just one of those gritty southpaw. He doesn't have the wrestling factor, but he's one of those gritty southpaw guys who makes matchups difficult. But and I was really close to having Dan Kelly, but in the old guy, of course I went with Randy Couture, beat him out. But Dan Kelly, y'all know I've been high on one-legged Kelly for a while.
Kelly was the guy I was alluding to earlier, where I was like, well, he's been an underdog every single UFC fight, like
shit, yes,
literally every single UFC fight. So he goes in there against Shoeface, for those that don't know what kind of level jiu-jitsu Shoeface has, just to give you an example, he recently flying triangled Gary Tonin. Does not simply flying triangle Gary Tonin, okay? So that's what this guy Shoeface did. And Dan Kelly goes out there, he gets his back taken by Shoeface in that first round. Now, most guys, they would have gotten tapped out there for sure, right? And Dan Kelly, not only does he not get tapped out, he survives. He makes it through the next round. He takes over, and then he finishes him in the third. Cashes that as a plus 450. I didn't pick him there, but whoever did, you're very sharp. His next fight against Chris Camozzi, he's a plus 220 dog. Goes out there, breaks Chris Camozzi, 30-27. Next fight, he's a dog to Rashad Evans, plus 200. Goes out there, gets the signature win over the legend, Rashad Evans. And now he's slated to fight Derek Brunson. And you know, he for the eighth time in a row, he's about to be the underdog again, so we'll see if he can pull it off, man. I'm always rooting for that guy.
Me too, man. It's gonna be tough as far as just my early lean looking into that next matchup. But I will give myself credit, although I was wrong and I was burned super bad from like Steve Montgomery on from Dan Kelly. I was on him in his last fight. I know you were as well, so that was definitely nice. But I was happy for Dan Kelly even when I was, you know, betting against the guy, because how can you not? But it was funny, like, I used to like bet against this guy so hard, like the guy fighting him would be under my recommended parlay piece. Like, I would be like, listen, the only way this bet doesn't cash is if like Dan Kelly's knee blows out on his walkout, and if that is a prop you can bet on, use that to hedge. Like, there's no way this doesn't, there's no way, like, seriously, if Dimes or some house offered a prop on like Dan Kelly's knee blows out on the way to the octagon, I can't say I wouldn't throw a quarter unit on that. Like, and then he keeps coming out and beating these guys, and it's crazy. I'm done counting that guy out. I'm done.
There's a podcast I listen to called The Secrets to Success podcast with Eric Thomas, and he says that phenomenal will beats phenomenal skill. And I truly believe that Dan Kelly is a prime example of that. Now, don't get me wrong, his judo skill is there. I mean, the guy's an Olympian, right? But it's really his phenomenal will that carries him through this fight. I mean, this guy, you know, he's taped up all over, you know, and I mean, he could break at any point, but the guy's so mentally tough. He stays in there. And also, man, his hand fighting is pretty damn good. He'll trap your wrist, throw a straight left down the pipe. He's super sneaky with it, man. So I
love it.
Much respect to Dan Kelly. Also, you know, I've had him on a half the battle a couple times, and super cool guy. I mean, firstly, all the guys from Australia, you know, Damian Brown, Volkanovski, Daniel Kelly, Robert Whitaker, they're all super, super cool guys. So, yeah, Dan Kelly has to be on anyone's underdog list, in my opinion, for sure, Dan.
Oh, absolutely, man. Absolutely. I mean, I could talk fights with you, Daniel, like all day, and that's why I had you on here, man, because you know your shit. You've not just been a fan forever, but you put the work in. You're one of the guys that's on the grind, watching the tape study, and I'm really glad I had you on here, man, for the top five underdogs, man. Thank you.
Dude, it was my honor to be on here. Thank you so much for having me. And before you let me go, can I name two more underdogs?
Oh, please. Yeah, anyone else, any other underdogs you want to get on the list, please go ahead. Fire away.
There's two I got to get off my chest. And this one, You know, a lot of people were waiting for me to mention this one. Well, why hasn't he said this one yet? James Vick. I mean, look, this guy is 6-1 in the UFC. All his fights are always lined close. I mean, he's usually always the underdog or a slight, you know, pick 'em. And what's interesting about him is that, so you remember his fight with Beneil Dariush, right? He got caught, man, and he got knocked out. Now, when someone takes a setback like that, you know, you say stuff like, okay, I hope the UFC gives him a softball and how's he going to recover and this and that. Well, the UFC didn't give him a softball at all, because when you talk about a guy like Abel Trujillo, that guy can knock out anyone in the weight class. I mean, we've seen Abel Trujillo face plant guys before. So Vic went out there like the Beneil Dariush fight never happened. And that was the best James Vic we've ever seen, you know, at least that I've ever seen, man. And also, you know, one thing, if you go back and you watch some or listen to some Half the Battle episodes, you know, we'd always talk about the weight cut because he is a really big guy for 155. The fight against Abel Trujillo was the first time where I was like, man, he's really, you know, he really looks like a 55er this time, man. You know, because before I was like, man, he should move up to 170. He would just feel so much better. And I still feel that way. He would feel a lot better. But this time against Abel Trujillo, I mean, he was the third guy in line for the early weigh-ins. You know what I mean? He had the perfect weight cut. And he really showed up, and the flying knees, his usage of you know, his range, obviously his boxing, his footwork, he's a mover, he pops dudes' heads back. So, you know, you watch his fight with Nick Hine, and like, dude, the way he was popping Nick Hine's head back with that jab and that 1-2, it's truly something to behold. And I'm also kind of curious why no one's gone to sleep from that flying knee yet. I feel like it's a matter of placement, because he lands it like every single fight, man. He's got a ridiculous flying knee. But finally in that Abel Trujillo fight, Abel was stumbling all over the place, shot for a desperation takedown, and got choked out. And also, Vic's wrestling has been criticized a lot, but I favor a good get-up game over good takedown defense any day. And, you know, when we talk about long-term investments, this guy's got a 91% win rate and an 85% win rate in the UFC. So this guy's a long-term winner, a long-term investment. He finds a way to win. He's mentally tough. I'd recommend betting on James Vick long-term.
Man, I'm glad you brought him up, because I don't even have the bias that you do, but through your show, I actually became a fan of Vick. You know, I mean, I like, you know, his fighting style, because it's similar attributes that we talked about. Max Holloway, he's the kind of guy that, if you know, in the underdog spirit, if you don't put him away, he's going to come back and find a way to win. He's going to put the pace on you, and he's going to find something to happen. But even personality wise, I dig the dude and stuff. It's really great hearing him when you have him on the show. I really dig when you do that. And even though I did, you know, pick against him in the Dariush fight, although reluctantly, because that fight I couldn't get a beat on. I didn't feel good about that one. I think that was on my avoids list. I was on Vic hard on this last one, and he did well, man. You talk about three round flyers. I only do that one a fight. I believe Vic was the one I did the last fight. And
nice.
And I also played
good basketball. Hit, man.
Oh yeah,
good,
because again, it's Vic, like what we just said. It's one of those guys who, if you let him back in the fight, that's only one part of the equation. What the other part of the equation is, you need somebody who fades. And boy, Abel Trujillo does himself some fading come mid second round. So that's the kind of equation that I'll look for when I'm playing those third round flyers. You know, for example, like, you know, I pretty much every time against Worley Alves, I've played it, and it almost happened twice. It was so close with both Barbarina and Usman. Like, he had him in the head and arm. I was like, come on, third round flyer. But it didn't make me feel bad, because I was like, okay, well, it didn't cash, but my head was in the right place. I'm not that crazy for playing these stupid props. But I only limit myself to one of those per card, and Vic was Santa Claus that night. So I appreciate that. Always happy for that guy regardless. Rooting for him now after listening to your show. But what's your last mention there, sir?
My last honorable mention, and it's kind of interesting because in his last, you know, maybe two fights, he was a heavy favorite. But prior to that, this guy's been the underdog in a lot of his fights, and that's Yair El Pantera Rodriguez. You know, this guy was a plus 200 against Charles Rosa, for starters, right? And, man, you know, what a lot of people's arguments for picking against this guy is, you know, flash doesn't work at the highest level and this and that. But here's my argument to that, Dan. Flash works if you have the fundamentals down. And, you know, a guy like Yair Rodriguez, even though, you know, you can still make the argument that he's a raw talent. He's putting every aspect of the game together. I mean, you watch his fight against Andre Fili. I know people only remember the flying head kick knockout, but what they don't remember is that in the first round he was blast doubling Andre Feely. You know what I mean? He's been working on his wrestling, getting better in every aspect of the fight. And also his jab is getting better because, look, you got to have a good jab if you're going to be throwing all that spinning shit, man. And his jab is getting better. Now he's taking on a guy like Frankie Edgar. He's back in the underdog role again, which he's been, you know, for most of his UFC career. I know the Alex Caceres fight and the BJ Penn fight, you know, he was a heavy favorite in those, but now he's back. He's a plus 155 underdog. And it's interesting because on, you know, one hand, you can make the argument, well, Frankie Edgar is going to give him his first UFC loss because everyone has to take that first UFC loss. No one is exempt. So you can make that argument. Frankie Edgar is going to go out there and school him. But you could also make the argument that, look, Frankie Edgar already lost two title fights at 145 pounds. There's only so many times you can climb back up the mountain, and he does get rocked in a lot of his fights. And with a guy like Yair Rodriguez and his kicks, the force of those kicks. Dude, BJ Penn, even to this day, he's got an insane chin still, man, because he was taking spinning heel kicks to the chin and just standing there like taking it. And then finally he crumbled in the second round. But man, I'm not convinced that Frankie Edgar can take those shots. And also, Yair's takedown defense has improved astronomically, man. So that is one fight to look out for. And since he does have a history of cashing as the underdog, I would recommend taking a look there.
Man, that's interesting. It shows how bad I am. Like, I'm bad about looking ahead of the odds. And now kind of I'll try not to unless I'm on there looking, and then I'll like curiously peek if I see something. But I didn't realize the odds on this one, and that is really interesting. Definitely worth it. And I like the point you make that even though BJ Penn and Frankie Edgar may be at different career spectrums, and you know their head-to-head bouts obviously went the way they did, that doesn't mean that their chins are necessarily that far off. So that's it's a really interesting viewpoint there that I agree with. You know, but it's one of those things in MMA where we get so washed with the narrative, a lot of these things get missed, and that's definitely a factoid that'll be sticking in my head, sir. So definitely, thank you for that. But yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited for this matchup now that we're talking about it. I almost want to go break it down right now. Right. So, you know, I love watching both these guys' styles to see how it's going to clash. It's definitely going to be a fun one, man. But Tim Bosch, real quick, I think is the only one that I see on my list that I didn't say, and he definitely deserves it. He's a career underdog, right? You'd say Tim Bosch.
The Hector Lombard fight, the Yushin Okami fight.
Oh, yeah.
He cashes an underdog in both of those.
Yeah, go listen to that Okami fight because, like, we're so desensitized to the Rogan, from every promo. But, like, listen to that. Like, he legitimately freaks out. And it comes through doubly because it's one of the first shows in Japan they did. And the arena, you know, if you're not familiar with Japanese MMA or just Japanese combat sport, they're very quiet and respectful. So you just hear Rogan like flipping balls. But but man, before we get out of here, please, take this time to plug your show and anything you got going on because it definitely deserves it, my man. I know we kind of plugged it in the beginning, but give yourself all the formal plugs here, sir. Please.
Well, Dan, firstly, man, thank you so much for having me on the Protect Your Neck podcast, man. Obviously, I'm a big fan of your work, as you know. All your written work is ridiculous, and now obviously you're back on, you know, you're doing a podcast now, which I'm very happy about. So, you know, it's a big honor to be on here, man. And if anyone wants to check me out, I have a podcast called Half the Battle. It's on iTunes, SoundCloud, YouTube, and Stitcher. And, you know, talk to exciting fighters and also break down the fights, man. You know, like I said, I'm on this show because of the underdogs, right? Well, you can get all my underdogs for free on Half the Battle, co-hosted by my good friend Sean Carey Tattoo. And then other times we got James Vick in there and all kinds of dudes, you know? So all kinds of awesome MMA personalities. So Dan, Tom, thanks again for having me, bro.
No problem, man. I'm not just saying it because, you know, you're on the show. I've said it on previous shows before that, you know, just like I hold myself as a reference and I tell people that, like, hey, listen, I'm proud of the work that I do and I put a lot of work into it. But techniques and picks can be two different things. And even picks and gambling, as you know, and as many yeah. people that they know, are two different things. So they're not all the same thing. Like, I'm definitely not the best. Like, I'll be the first to admit I'm far from the best gambler in plays. Like, I put that stuff out there. There's a lot of thought into it. And I put my money where my mouth is, I assure you. But I'll be the first to admit when there's better people out there, or there's, if not better people, people that you definitely should have on your list. And he's probably too nice to admit it, but you know, him and his co-host Sean Carey are awesome when it comes to plays. I believe they're far better than me when it comes to that. So you guys definitely should add them to your list as far as referencing for podcasts, because they have a lot of great angles on there for betting angles. And we got to talk about some of those angles a bit with today's show with underdog themes. But they really do a good job in their show of breaking things down top to bottom. So if you want to kind of add to your pool more of the gaming side of things, please go check out Half the Battle. Daniel.
Thank you. Thank you very much, my friend. Also, if anyone wants to follow me on Twitter, you can at Best Fight Picks. And you can go to bestfightpicks.com for my plays as well. And again, Dan, thanks so much, my man.
No problem, man. Always preaching the free content. I appreciate that you stick to the grind. You guys put yourself put your work out there for the general masses. I do the same. And like I said, man, we got to respect each other in this community, man. And not just respect each other and it's all good, but you end up actually making friends with some really cool people in the process. So I'm really glad I've been able to make friends with you, man. Thank you for having me on your show as well. I'm sure this isn't the first time we'll be doing either of our shows. As this community gets stronger, it's good to be strong with the people within it. And Daniel's definitely one of those people, man. So thank you all for listening. You all know where you can follow me, at The MM Analyst for all my work, mixedmartialanalyst.com for this podcast, as well as iTunes. We are, yes, I'm using this break in time. We are coming to SoundCloud. I am looking into a YouTube channel for multiple content, not just the podcast, but for other stuff. So things are in the work. I am keeping myself busy during this little break. And we'll be back for another top 10, probably doing a top 5 bad tattoos with John Lee. John's Crazy Life. That's going to be a very, very fun one.
Nice.
We're probably going to have a little drinks and be slinging some fire, but all in the spirit of fun. So please stay tuned to that. And follow us at the PYM Podcast on Twitter. And that's about it, man. And until next time, protect your neck.